greetings and a warm welcome to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik. Thank you for stopping by today. I hope you're staying warm wherever you are. Each day now we are getting closer and closer to winter, well, at least in the northern hemisphere. I hope you had a good Samhain or Samhain. We are going to, kind of continue a bit on the Halloween trail today and talk more about activities bound to other realms. Tracy Twyman is our guest today. She's an author and commentator who approaches historical research from an esoteric perspective. She's probably best known for her book The Merovingian Mythos and her underground cult magazine Dagobert's Revenge. In recent years, she has also pioneered what she calls alchaeoeconomics, the study of relationship between alchemy, economics, and the evolution of money through the ages. She has a new book out that is called Clock Shavings that we'll be talking about today. We are going to go on the Holy Bloodline Trail of the Templars and talk about some of the background to the Priory of Sion stories and tie in how Tracy uses different methods of extracting information from what some claim are demonic entities like Baphomet and Cain. If it can be trusted, we leave up to you to decide. But we'll also talk about witch cults in the West, which is quite interesting, and specifically more about if the concept of demons and evil satanic activities are simply Christian interpretations or maybe propaganda of pagan rites and gods. We'll try to go outside of the confines of the Judeo-Christian story to see if there's more to it than that. Welcome back, Tracy. Thank you for being on the program again. It's been, it's been over 3 years ago since we last spoke. It's good to have you back. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. You know, it has been 3 years, and yet I still get emails about that show and people who have just heard of me from that show. So I think it was a really good show for me to do, and I'm really happy to be back on. And I got to say that, you know, because I'm ignorant, you know, of so many things, I'm just not paying attention to everything. I knew Red Ice was a popular website and everything before I did the first interview. But, you know, it was just on the list of podcasts that have asked me to be on. And, you know, I didn't think much of it at the time. It was just another interview. And the response I got to that show was so huge. I really have to thank you. And I just thought, I wanted to slap myself. I thought, how could you not understand how big this show is? And now I finally realize it. So, and that's why I wrote to you and said, this is the one show that I asked to be on, because, you know, I get lots of good response from it. And also, I recall that you're a particularly good interviewer. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm much more modest than that. But thank you. I really appreciate that. That's good to hear, though. We like to hear that. Thank you. Well, Tracy, a lot has been going on since we last spoke. Obviously, you have a new, very interesting book out, Clock Shavings. And I've been going through it here in the last few days. And I mean, let's just kind of start at the beginning here, because it's a very, well, I'd say it's a bizarre and an interesting story that you've been part of for quite some years now. Give us some of the background on the book and the content, kind of how this came together, because it's been unfolding basically while you've been, you know, writing all the other books and doing all the other work. So how did it come together?
Well, basically this is the story of how I got started into esoteric research and writing and some of the source material, I guess, or inspiration for some of the researches I've done. And in particular, I focus on, this is the story of what I call the Ordo Lapsus Exilis, which is a secret society that my friends and I had at the time when I was publishing Dagobert's Revenge magazine. That was a magazine about esoteric history, secret societies, you know, divine royal bloodlines and things like that. And doing research to write articles for that magazine, and also working on my first book, which came out a few years later, which was The Merovingian Mythos. My friends and I decided to actually sort of get inspiration from Beyond the Veil by tapping into, using the Ouija board basically to tap into spirits, deceased spirits that would know something about the subjects we were researching. So it started out with my husband, Brian. Well, he wasn't my husband at the time, but we got married shortly afterwards. We were publishing the magazine together, and we started talking to Jean Cocteau on the Ouija board. And we hadn't ever done it before, and we didn't really expect it to work. We just tried it out, and it worked really well the first time. And so then we ended up doing more of that, and we ended up talking to a lot more characters besides just Jean Cocteau. In fact, we mostly talked to, I would say, demonic spirits. And I ended up, that actually ended up being the source for a lot of my research. You know, I didn't necessarily take everything that the spirits told me on the Ouija board for granted, but it was a springboard for a lot of my research. A lot of the things that they told us ended up being true, and stuff that we wouldn't have been able to figure out on our own. And so it became a really useful resource. And that's, years later, I decided to write a book about all of the seances, including some of the transcripts that I have, and analysis of some of the meaning of what was in those seances. There's also just the personal story, the narrative of what was going on between me and my friends in the Ordo Lapsed Exilis at the time, and some of the things that we got persuaded to do, I would say, by the contact that we had with the demonic spirits, where they basically taught us how to do magic and magic rituals, and we tried out some of that. And so those experiences are in the book as well.
Well, indeed. All right, let's just tackle this one first, and the Ouija board, to kind of get that out of the way, I guess. I wanted to ask you about this with consideration, I guess, from the skeptic, with the doubtful person in mind here using the Ouija board and whatnot. What would you say in terms of, you know, why this works, and in terms of what you were talking with, how did you manage to identify with what you're talking with, basically?
Well, okay. First of all, how it works, it seems, you know, I didn't expect it to work in the first place. So it was, how it works is something I sort of had to learn over time. And it's basically, it seems like the spirit comes through you and your partner somehow to move the planchette through your hands. Like, you know, people say that you can do automatic writing where a spirit comes into you and uses your hand basically as a tool. And I think that's what this is. But for some reason, for me at least, it only works when there's at least one other person. In fact, I think it works better with just two and not several other hands on the planchette. It seems to weight it down too much. But it seems like, you know, if you can just, it doesn't take much effort. And for some of the partners that I've had, it didn't seem to take a lot of preamble. You know, you just clear your mind a little bit and then put your hands on and start talking. And I just got answers right away. And you can tell that it's not coming from you, especially when they start spelling out things you don't even know the meaning of. And they spell them out too fast for you to read it in your head. You have to write it down to be able to figure out what they're saying. You know, it's just, to me, it was obvious that I'm getting a message from beyond. And with at least most of the partners I worked with, they felt the same way. You know, I only had one or two people I worked with who were just so skeptical they couldn't handle it. And usually the Ouija board wouldn't work very well with those people.
Oh, is that so? That's interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess because it's hostility, basically. They're not allowing the spirit to come in and use them. They're just hostile and pushing it off. And so I think that's why it doesn't work. But, you know, even then, I still got results. It's just I got the spirits not wanting to talk very much. So, I mean, it's been really surprising to me that actually it seems to work on some level every single time. Whereas I know I've talked to some people that say they've tried and they just can't get anything. You know, it just sits there underneath their hands. So I know that that I guess not everyone can do it, although, you know, I've met quite a lot of people that have. And since this book came out, I guess I've inspired some people. I don't know if that's good or bad, but a lot of people have been trying it out. And amazingly, it seems like some of these people are basically, they're talking to the same spirits I was talking to and almost continuing the same conversations. They're getting the same type of language and getting messages that are consistent with the ones we were getting.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit here later about, you know, who you were talking with and some of the things that came out. There's a lot to it there. But let's back up just a little bit before that. You started Ordo Lapsus Exilis after you read, I guess, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Benjamin Lee and Lincoln, right? So, and as far as I read it, I understood it was kind of a way of just mimicking of what was going on. It was kind of like you didn't really know what you were doing, right?
And
you
just kind of,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was just basically Dagobert's Revenge was inspired by the magazines that were put out by the Priory of Zion in the 50s and 60s. And those were basically, they were deposited in libraries in France. They were very low circulation. And the idea, I think, behind the publication was to let other people know that there was a secret society and to kind of plant ideas about what that society might be up to and start rumors, basically, about the Priory of Zion. And it worked because that was the source material for the people that wrote Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So all the theories that ended up in the Da Vinci Code years later, it all started with these Frenchmen just putting these magazines out, implying that there was this secret society and that it was allied to a royal bloodline coming from Jesus, and they were going to bring them back to the thrones of Europe. So I read that story about what the Priory of Zion had done, and I was 18 at the time, and I just decided that I would put out a magazine making a similar implication that there was a secret society behind it that either was connected to the Priory of Zion or was the Priory of Zion. I think that was the original idea. And in a more general sense, it was marketed as a secret society for the research of the mysteries of the Holy Grail. And so when we published this magazine, we would just put that it was published by Ordo Lapsus et Excellus in there. And, we would have our logo was the Cross of Lorraine. So we would put that in there too. And basically that was all the order did was be spoken of in that way for a few years. That's all it was. And then I would say when we started talking to these spirits, especially, okay, Jean Cocteau referred us to another spirit, Cain, Cain of the Bible. And then Cain talked to us for a while and ended up telling us we needed to speak to Baphomet. And I would say once we started talking to Baphomet, it's kind of when we made, I would say, our connection with the outer head, the real spiritual leader or guide, I guess, of our organization. Basically, we're told that he had been trying to influence us the entire time, ever since I had started Dagobert's Revenge. I got the impression that he was the one who had inspired it, because it was a very inspired idea at the time when I got it. And we were told that he had cursed us. Specifically, we were supposed to, I had made an agreement with a friend, a colleague, another writer, whose name was Nicholas Devere, to help him publish one of his books. And then I had ignored that promise. I just forgot about it, or put it on the back burner, I guess, and hadn't done much with it. So when we were told by Cain to talk about, we were told that we had been cursed by Baphomet because we hadn't published this book yet, that Baphomet really wanted Nicholas Devere's book to be published. And I guess that started the whole process of, strangely, my husband and I sort of feeling like Baphomet was in charge of our lives in a way, or that, he was, like I said, the outer head of our order, the inspiration for the writing and work that I was doing. And so it seems like at that point we started to structure the order into a real thing, and we were actually inspired, told by Baphomet, to go ahead and open it up to the public, create outer degrees of the order that people from the public could join, and kind of run it like the AMORC, where the Rosicrucian order, where they just do sort of mail order initiations and send people literature in the mail, and that's how they run their order. We were being told that we should start trying to do that with the Ordo Lapsus et Excellus, and also that we should do more divination and rituals to try to make things happen, to affect reality. Ultimately, we got persuaded that we were supposed to try to somehow put Nicholas Devere on like the throne of the world, basically. That he was destined to be the king of the world and the Grail King, and that we had to do magic rituals and also propaganda with our order to try to make that come about. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch, I guess, of how we came to have this relationship with Baphomet, and how the Ordo Lapsus et Excellus became, a
I don't know, a functioning secret society for a while, I guess.
Right, right. Okay, well, let's talk more about that later, but can you tell us a bit more about Nicholas Devir von Drakenberg and your relationship with him? It's interesting and kind of a bizarre character in my book, anyway. What do you make of him?
Well, I always liked him, and I always liked his writing. He wrote a book that seemed like it was also inspired. It seemed like it was had been written through automatic writing in a way, but he would never say that. He said that it was the history of his family. The book ended up being published under the name The Dragon Legacy. And he said that he was bloodline that was the same as Holy Blood, Holy Grail wrote about, what they called the Grail family. Of course, in that book, they talk about a bloodline coming from Jesus. And Nicholas Devir was saying Jesus is in the family tree, but really the origin of this bloodline is in the ancient, and it really comes from the fallen angels. Breeding with humans, the story of the Nephilim, and that's really basically the story of the bloodline of Satan.
Is that an antithetical bloodline to the bloodline of Jesus, if that even existed?
I don't think so. Well, I guess the holy supernatural bloodline, and and there's characters that are good and bad in that bloodline, but they're all related. You know, it's very Star Wars in a way. You know, you've got, I think, both good and evil characters coming from this bloodline, but they're all connected.
Right.
So, that's what his book was about. You know, he's got not only the history written about his family, but also literally, like, what he says were accurate genealogies going back, connecting himself and other characters in modern days all the way back to like ancient Sumerian gods and things like that, you know. So he had what he claimed to be, you know, the most complete genealogy going back to the gods of the ancient world, including gods that are considered by monotheists now to be Satan.
Right.
So
yep.
Anyway, so that's what he was saying, and that was basically his. He never said he wanted to have any sort of political power, but he did say that he had this entity that he was in charge of that he could create as a real state, a functioning state, and any time if he wanted to. He said he had the right to it, and for whatever reason, he claimed that the British royal family and some of the governments of the world would recognize his claim to this political entity if he ever chose to create it. He said he was the king of Drakenberg, and that if he ever had, you know, bought a private island or anything like that and tried to make it his own territory, he would have the right to do that and other people would recognize it. So he had a group called the Dragon Court, which was supposedly all members of this bloodline. And it was always a different cast of characters. Every few years it would be a new set of people, and the people who had left would always be his enemies and hated him. And they always had this compulsion to start their own dragon courts and claim that they were the king of Drakenberg and everything. So it was like really a group of just insane egomaniacs, very delusional people. And I wouldn't say that, I mean, he was too, but the one thing he had going for him was he was a talented writer. He was very smart. And he had come up with a theory that if you were to believe it would put together a lot of the missing pieces in history and also connections between different esoteric schools of thought. So I thought his book and his ideas were very exciting. And that's why I liked him in the first place. That's why I became his friend and agreed to help him publish his book. And then, you know, when I heard Baphomet talking about him, that's when I guess we sort of took it seriously, like, well, maybe there's something to this, you know, maybe on a magical level, at least on a spiritual level, there's truth to what he's saying. And so, you know, we just sort of went with it. And the Ordo Lapsus Exilis ended up forming an official alliance with the Dragon Court. And that's how it gained this agenda, I guess, of trying to bring about the kingdom of Drakenberg on Earth. Although, you know, that only happened sort of at the end. We only were pushing that or talking about that for really only a few months before I closed the order down. But for a while there, that was part of what we were doing.
So you kind of have your doubts about him, but yet intrigued by the writing and some of the circumstantial things that have occurred around him, I guess. But does he, if he ended up on the throne of the world, does he detail anywhere how he would run it? What's his manifesto?
No. Well, that's sort of the thing, is it's not a recognizable form of political power in the way that we think of it.
Right. But even if it was influential power, we that's what we largely have today as well. We have, you know, people in front of the leadership and then those behind it. Let's say if he were behind it, does he detail anywhere in terms of how he would prefer things to be run?
I wouldn't say he details it at all. In fact, we were just talking about, here's the idea that you put him on the throne, you have a ritual to ceremonially enthrone him. And then I wrote this in a document that I wrote through automatic writing one night. I was just inspired about this whole thing. So I wrote this document that was supposed to be a secret manual for the second degree members of our order. And it was all about, or part of it at least, was about this Drakenberg concept and what would happen if we put him on the throne and the magical process of the ceremony that would occur. And then what would happen, supposedly, this is the way I envisioned it, is that Baphomet, who's this, you know, fallen angel spirit who's locked in the abyss, basically, in hell, would be released from his prison as soon as his descendant, Prince Nicholas de Vere, is placed upon the throne of the world, the Grail throne. And so when that moment occurs, Nicholas, the way we envisioned it, would die, and actually the spirit would become indwelling in him, and he would become, you know, a more than human dragon king. He would be Baphomet in human form. And so it was really all about bringing Baphomet to the throne, really. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't about Nicholas de Vere's, you know, what his tax policies would be or anything like that.
See, that's what I wanted to know. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
No, it was just a very, it was a spiritual concept, I guess you could call it.
Right.
You know, it's a political agenda at all.
Okay. So we have, you know, Cain, we have Lucifer, you had a discussion with Satan as well. We can maybe talk more about that later, but these are largely, you know, obviously biblical characters. That particular area is something I want to talk about later. But as far as Baphomet is concerned, I guess it isn't, right? I mean, what do we know about who or what that is? Because as far as I've been able to tell peripheral research, what Alphonse Louis, who later changed his name to the Jewish name Eliphaz Levi, he brought together the symbol, I guess, as such in the 1850s. But the only earlier references to Baphomet was actually the Islamic mosque, the word for that, Baphomerias, I think, and that was or Baphomets, I think, and that appeared somewhere around, you know, in the 1100s or something like that. This was occurring during the Crusade times or whatnot. But what do you know about the character and what the origins of that is and how it relates to the biblical characters per se? Because it's not something mentioned in the Bible.
Right. Well, I guess I learned that over time, because when we first made contact with him, I didn't know much more than what you just said. I mean, I knew that the Templars basically had been, you know, persecuted in 1307 for engaging in, you know, heretical, blasphemous rituals. And that part of, at least according to their confessions, part of that was worshiping or venerating an idol called Baphomet. And that, it was described as a severed head, and also that in the same ritual, sometimes the guys would say that they had to kiss the backside of a goat. So I think there were those two things, the severed head and the goat, that's part of the same ritual. Those two things kind of got fused together, and they may have been fused together back then. or Eliphas Levi may have had a lot to do with putting the ideas together. But I think also that I tend to believe, okay, the writings of this one Orientalist who said that he found, his name was Johann von Hammer Purgstall. He said that he found seals and graphic depictions amongst the Templars' possessions of a creature that looks similar to what Eliphas Levi ended up producing an image of, which is a hermaphroditic human being with a goat head and wings. And there's something pretty much of that description in some of these drawings that are in von Purgstall's book about the Templars, where, you know, he said that he got that stuff directly from their properties and their own coins and the walls of their preceptories and you know, things that they had produced.
So something that kind of came together, I guess, during that time for whatever reason. What if any, is the Islamic connection, do you think, here?
That's hard to describe, and I don't think it's, I'm not sure there's really a quote, I don't think it's Islamic necessarily, right. But I think that the Templars might have had some contacts with mystics who happened to speak Arabic and were telling them details about traditions of this demon, basically. And, you know, so some of the Arabic words that they use might have ended up in some of the Templar rituals about Baphomet. But I think, go ahead.
That's interesting. Please remember where you were. I just wanted to squeeze in there. Do you think that it could be, because we have a lot of ancient that people today would refer to as pagan or heathen traditions from around the world before the Abrahamic religions come into play. Would this, do you think, maybe be one of those remnants that was worshipped or something like that, let's say in the Middle East before, you know, Islam kind of became the force that it is today?
Yes, yes. Thank you, because I guess that's the short way of saying what I'm trying to say. I have a book that I'm writing that's almost done now that gets into this stuff in a bit more detail. But it's very difficult to describe succinctly how that all came about, that Arabic influence into this idea. I don't want to get into it right now because it's so freaking complicated.
No, I got you. But it's so intriguing and interesting there, because, I mean, if we look at the first crusaders and whatnot, I mean, a lot of them, I know, were from the northern lands as well. They managed to recruit a lot of people. And, I mean, they were barely even into Christianity yet. They still probably had clinging on to the dual faith. I don't know about the Franks. They've certainly been Christianized for a longer period. The further down south you go in Europe, you know, you would have more Christianity there established. But since there was plenty of northern knights and whatnot, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some people who, you know, kind of recognized some of the older faiths here. And maybe there was an interesting kind of syncretic overlap between some of the deities that they potentially even encountered down in the Middle East, you know?
Yes, that's probably true. But I think that the reaction that the Templars had, the ones that started the whole thing, those first nine knights that are mentioned in the history as the ones that founded the order, there, when they encountered him, I think they had a very Christianized reaction to it, and that the whole mythos of Baphomet has ever since then been Christianized and is seen from a Christian point of view, even if it's also a satanic point of view. You know that Satanism basically couldn't exist without the Christian point of view.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And so what I think Baphomet is really, is the fusion of the demons Lilith and Samael. And Lilith and Samael were described by the Jewish Kabbalists as being hermaphroditic in the first place. They were, he says that the Kabbalists say that Lilith and Samael were the serpent in the Garden of Eden. It was this hermaphroditic, demonic spirit that, you know, tempted Adam and Eve in the garden, actually bred with both of them. The male side bred with the female human and vice versa. And there were these serpent bloodlines that came out of that. This is, I think, what Nicholas de Vere was talking about when he talked about the dragon bloodline. And basically, I think that, you know, that's just the Jewish Kabbalist word for this spirit, this entity that's out there somewhere that is antithetical to what we call God. For whatever reason, this spirit has always resented mankind. And at the same time, humans have had relationships with it you know, there's been sexual relationships with this spirit. Like I said, there's bloodlines coming from unions between this spirit and humans, going back to Adam and Eve. And then also, this is the spirit that initiates have always turned to get hidden information about the universe and information about how to do what we call magic, how to utilize supernatural powers and how to gain information that maybe God doesn't want you to have. So that's why I think that it's, you know, the contact with the spirit and the veneration of this spirit and doing rituals with the power of this spirit has become what we call Satanism.
Right.
And so I think that that's what the Templars got into, that this spirit, the cult surrounding it, there must have been evidence of it there in Jerusalem, where the Templars, you know, had their headquarters and where they were supposedly doing digging and finding all sorts of artifacts. They probably came across something that gave them contact with the spirit. And it could have been, you know, everyone has these rumors about that they found the skull of John the Baptist, and that's what the Baphomet skull is. Actually, Baphomet told us that's true. I think that if you have a contact with a relic that is a touch point for a particular spirit, that can just start the whole thing. The rituals with Baphomet that the Templars had were divinatory in nature, that they were actually using the head to speak to them. So I was just using the Ouija board to speak to Baphomet, and they were using a head. It's the same thing, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm having the same sort of relationship as they were having. So anyway, that's, I guess, I know that's a long answer, but basically you were asking, you know, what was Baphomet and what, you know, how did it connect to Christianity? I think it connected with these Jewish traditions having to do with basically the serpent, the devil.
So it's the antithetical, because I think that this whole play here that goes back and forth is very interesting. And it's kind of, well, to be honest, you don't know what is what. Because I know a lot of people today that would say that they would consider Yahweh to be the equivalent of what people have a perception of what Satan is, for example. And it's kind of bizarre here that these knights that were supposed to be, you know, representing Christianity gets attracted to something where they're very much just very shortly afterwards are accused by the French, you know, portion of the papacy basically to be heretics, you know, and are thrown out for that reason. They're suppressed and they break up the order. But mm-hmm. all of these sources are, as far as I know, largely from Jewish myths and Jewish authors, the Bible, the Pentateuch, and it seems to just be kind of be involving in that world, if you will. I mean, I'm not that I want to take this off track already, but it always seems to evolve these types of entities. It's always the biblical names that come up. In your view, is there anything outside of this in terms of, I mean, there's so many deities out there. Is this ever something that you've encountered? Might be a sidetrack here, but just a curious question. I mean, Celtic deities, Norse deities, any other kind of Western esoteric tradition that is steeped in a more prior heathen or pagan tradition. What about that?
Well, the results we got, the sorts of answers we got from these spirits, indicated that those other gods are out there. And also there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of the same names being applied to or different names being applied to the same spirits. So, you know, I don't have any reason to believe that, I guess, you know, if you're asking, is the Judeo-Christian point of view the only reality, and does anything else exist outside of that? I mean, I have no reason to believe there isn't more, you know. It's just that, yeah, this is what we tapped into. And so
right.
These are the kind of answers that we got. And mainly, you know, I had been researching and writing about Templars and Freemasonry and what Western occultism, that's all coming from that, influenced by that. So we didn't spend a lot of time asking them about Norse gods and things like that. But, you know, if I had, I think I would have gotten some answers. I think even though I've been doing this for 13 years, still, you know, it's not like something I do every day. And it's been very hard, actually, to get people to work with me. A lot of people get kind of burnt out on it, or it's too tiring. So I guess my point is just, it takes a lot of effort to get the material that I've gotten. And a lot of times these are conversations that drag on for weeks, you know? And so I haven't had a chance to research everything or to ask.
Oh, sure.
About
no,
every
no.
Spirit
or, no, I know that. Know. No,
I think that I could, you know, basically, mm-hmm. if I had this, if this was like my full-time job or something, and I had, you know, people to work with that were good and competent, you know, we could just write books and books and books full of what the spirits say about how things work. What's it like in the universe? What's the hidden history of things? You could just go on forever. And I think you'll keep getting results. And the more you know about something, the more you know the right questions to ask. And then they're, you know, because they can read your mind pretty much. They know they know how much you know, and therefore they know how much information they can give you. Like if you don't know anything about Norse mythology, they can give you lots of information that'll just fly right past your head.
Right.
I mean, that's been happening. Like, okay, I get lots of stuff about Sumerian gods, and I get words that look like they're Sumerian, although. Cain, usually the one who's speaking these words, says that language is actually Aryan. He calls it Aryan. But anyway, I've gotten so many things in other languages that I didn't even know were meaningful at the time. I wrote them down, but I thought it was just nonsense words. And it turns out, you know, when I finally look it up or run across it sometime later, that it's actually a Sumerian word. You know, and there's actually a meaning to what he said. So, you know, basically, yeah, if I sat down and wanted to find out all about Norse mythology, I'm sure I'd be told that stuff. And also, I'd be told how to synchronize it with everything else. That's kind of what we were trying to do. We weren't trying to just figure out the Judeo-Christian perspective. We were trying desperately to sync everything up, all of the different mythologies. My point of view was that there must be some way to put them all together. I mean, not that every single aspect can be put together, but you know, there's so many similar stories in different cultures and gods that can be equivocated between different cultures and, you know, other heroes and figures in the mythologies. So we were trying to do comparative mythology and comparative religion as best we could with the help of spirits from beyond who would have a better perspective on that stuff than we would. And I think we got some useful information there. But yeah, I think just because we were, you know, our bent or perspective was having to do with Freemasonry and the Templars, that's the type of information we got.
Oh, definitely. No, I definitely understand. Let's talk more about Freemason later. I know it's so often ends up in this realm, and it's almost like there's a disconnection between those who, you know, kind of research, let's say, old, more pagan European myths and whatnot, as opposed to what some of the activities that, you know, occultists and esotericists do. And it feels like there's an entire, you know, pantheon, entire worlds there that are circumvented. And I know that there's so much more out there. But having said that, I think that there is an overlap as when Christianity came in, it's clear that much of the, you know, heathen gods of the old faiths of the European peoples were definitely deemed to be, you know, satanic or Satan, Lucifer, or any other number of demons. In fact, I think there might even be a tie-in with how your book title came about. Tell us about clock shavings, because there's an interesting story in there.
Oh, well, yeah, I basically took this from a quote from the anthropologist. Her name was Margaret Alice Murray. She wrote this book in the 20s called The God of the Witches, and it was all about the witchcraft covens that used to exist in Europe and in England. And a lot of this information, it's just like the Templars. It was derived from confessions of people that were, you know, being persecuted for witchcraft. But again, like the confessions of the Templars, when you get the same story told over and over again, you know, you start to believe it, I guess, or I do. When I look at these histories, I think, you know, they're probably telling the truth. To some extent, I don't think it was all just tortured into them and forced out of them. I think that this is what the real witchcraft tradition is. And what the confessions were basically is just that they would have black masses or sabbats, and the goat god would appear to them, and they would give their soul to him in a ritual. And so the quote from Margaret Alice Murray that I use in the very beginning of the book, I'll read it for you. "The Swedish witches had a special rite which was obviously intended to impress ignorant minds. They were given a little bag containing a few shavings of a clock to which a stone was tied. They threw this into the water, saying, 'As these shavings of the clock do never return to the clock from which they are taken, so may my soul never return to heaven.'"
Yeah.
And this quote ends up in a song by Coven in the 70s, a satanic rock band, that it was all about, the song was about the Black Mass. And so, yeah, it's a quote about, you know, selling your soul to the devil, I guess. And the reason why I used it is just because, you know, I didn't feel like I was engaging in Satanism in the beginning of this endeavor when I started talking to all these spirits on the Ouija board. But over time, you know, I got to know Baphomet better. And it, like I say in the book, we did end up talking to Lucifer and Satan specifically. You know, I kind of felt like I got pushed, or I guess enticed into that direction. And, you know, I do feel like at this point, I'm not sure, you know, even though I wouldn't call myself a Christian and haven't called myself that for a long, long time, still the point of view, you know, that you grew up with, you never get rid of it. And the paranoia that it leaves you with, the fear of losing your eternal soul, that never leaves you. And certainly after going through this whole experience with all these spirits telling me point blank, you know, that they are evil, they hate God, they hate humans, you know, I can't help but feel like after all I've been through and all the things I've done for them and with them, that you know, I fear that maybe I've done something that I can't reverse. And also, I'm not even sure you would know. And that's, I say that because I've been researching the concept of the Faustian Pact for a couple of years now, and seeing how the theme appears in different movies and fairy tales and literature of all sorts. And it seems to me that the person who makes such a pact doesn't always realize it afterwards. And I think what happens basically is your soul actually goes to the other side as soon as you make this pact. And the demon really is what's indwelling in your body from that point on. So you're watching yourself live life from that moment onward, it's basically in a fog, because you're trapped on the other side watching yourself. And, you know, sometimes I feel that way, basically. I feel like that's happening to me. I've talked to other people who have the same feeling sometimes. And so I don't know. That's kind of why I called the book that.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting.
That's my answer, I guess.
Definitely. No, it's an interesting story there with clock shavings. And I actually looked a little bit at Margaret Alice Murray's work. She wrote that, you know, The Witch Cult in Western Europe in 1921, and I think actually some of the more detailed accounts of that actually were from Sweden. And as you read in the quote, yes, the Swedish witches, that's what the quote is about, right? And it's interesting because the more you look into her work, she actually talks about a place, and it's actually the wrong translation in the English. She talks about Blockula, which is, you know, she describes that it's this nest, basically, where all the witches, they gather there. They, in some of the stories from the 1600s, they actually fly there on their brooms. And, you know, much of the, you know, classical imagery of the witches, you know, comes from some of these observations, I guess, or myths or whatever you want to call them from Sweden at the time in the 1600s. But nonetheless, it's actually Blå Kulla, not Blockkulla, which means Blue Mountain or whatnot. And we actually have a place like that. It's kind of a long story. I don't want to get too long-winded with it, but it actually has to do with the tie-in between the old heathen faith and when Christianity comes in, because this particular mountain in Sweden, and she, as she describes it in the book as I was reading it, it's like, oh, it's actually quite fitting, because, you know, on a clear day, you can actually see it. It has a blue, you know, it's not a huge mountain. It's more like a plateau mountain, but it's called a Blue Mountain. And what's interesting about this place is that it's speculated by local legends and people who've researched some of the alternative history of Sweden, that this is actually a pretty good candidate of where the potential heathen temple at one place might have been. So it would make sense that these witches, quote unquote witches, would actually come and gather at these locations. This is where the, you know, everyone who's worshiping, you know, Asatru and stuff like that today, they're all looking for this temple, which were situated in at a place called Uppsala. And today there's a place called Uppsala near Stockholm, but it was actually renamed in the 1300s. It was named Aros from the beginning, but now today it's called Uppsala. But there is actually an Uppsala around this, where this very mountain is. So anyway, make a long story short, there is a connection here etymologically and myth-wise and whatnot, that the Blå Kulla actually refers to this mountain, and the potential location of the great Norse heathen temple might actually have been on this very mountain. So I just think it's a really interesting story there. And the fact that they were, when Christianity came in, this would be considered to be, you know, witchcraft. It kind of makes sense when you begin to piece it together, you know?
Yes. And, you know, in a way that reminds me of, I guess, a point I wanted to make earlier. You were asking about the, you know, whether or not the pre-Christian reality has any meaning, I guess, is what you're asking. And I think that what we call witchcraft and Satanism, ever since Christianity, you know, conquered a large portion of the world, that it's sort of, again, it's a reaction to that. Yeah, it's like there were these pagans before, and then the Christians came in. So, you know, some people tried to sort of combine the Christianity with the paganism. So you got things like Santeria and all sorts of, you know, just local traditions in Ireland and places like that, where they kind of just put the Catholic veneer or the Christian veneer on the pagan rites.
Right. Yeah.
But then also you have, if you got like a few more generations after Christianity comes, the next generation grows up with, you know, two opposing realities, basically, as their tradition and their reality. You know, they've got their base, probably maybe their mother or father teaching them the old ways, and then also they're in a Christian society, and maybe they're even taught by their mother or father that you have to hide this, or you have to be both at the same time. So I think that, I guess what I'm saying is, I think that Satanism comes out of that in a way where people sort of take on the evil that they're being told
exactly
that they're practicing.
Yes.
You know, it's like you wear it as a badge after a while, that
and you do it to rebel against the Christianity too, right? You fulfill that role that they want you to have. In effect, you become even more entrapped by the very Christianity you claim that you oppose, right? To a certain extent.
Exactly. And then the thing too is, like, it seems from my experience, magic really is, in a way, what Aleister Crowley said about it. You know, you are creating your own reality. So these gods, it seems, they have some sort of external existence, but we really have a lot of influence on that. And I think, to a certain extent, you could say whatever we think is real about the other world and our relationship to it, that's what it is, you know, because our our point of view is defining that at any given moment. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I think that the, what am I trying to say? I'm just trying to say, I think we've all influenced it over time. It's always evolving over time. So in a way, the sort of satanic relationship between these older spirits, the pagan gods, and humans has evolved into Satanism, and not just from the point of view of the humans practicing it, but even from the point of view of the spirits, or satanic spirits, I think, can even be created. You know, I think you can, if you wanted to just go from scratch, start and like invent a deity or a spirit and project it into the ether with your mind and make it real and start worshiping it and create a whole religion around it. And, you know, lots of people have done this, actually. I think that that would have some sort of reality to it and effect, and it would start to change the reality of the spiritual relationship between our world and the other world. Because I think the other world is not actually real. It's something that's a product of our relationship with it. I'm not saying it's entirely invented or projected by us, but we affect the relationship, and therefore we affect the reality of it. So anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that I know I'm making it too complicated, but basically I'm saying I think that what was paganism before, you know, has become Satanism, and not just in a fake sense, but in a real sense, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that's kind of a shame also, because it's being tainted by what is being imposed upon it, and it's not the true and real paganism of the day. So I think it's important to analyze and understand what people are involved in, and you know, if they are they Satanists in the context of Christianity, or are they, you know, paganists, heathens, if you will. There's a clear distinction there. But let's pick this up in a little bit here, sure. Tracy, because we're going to take a short break here. In a moment, we're going to talk a little bit more about the book, of course, the website where people can go to pick up copies of it. We've kind of barely just scratched the surface here of some of the things that you do go into in the book. But I just quickly wanted to mention that too, by the way, because we have a pretty good contender, to where this great heathen temple of the Norse gods actually were, the place where the Asir actually was worshipped. And this has been heavily debated, in terms of Swedish history. And it comes... Many people go to the sources, and it comes after this German medieval chronicler called Adam of Bremen in Germany, who wrote about this when he traveled to this place called, Uppsala. But it's not the Uppsala that you think it is. He actually describes a place that, if you look at the description, is more likely further to the south of Sweden as opposed to the Uppsala around the Stockholm area today. But nonetheless, they've not found remnants of this temple. That was burnt in about 1080, that effectively marks the end of the Viking Age and all the Blut, celebrations that took place every 9 years. So that's a fascinating story there, that there's a lot of information about that actually kind of ties into this story to a certain extent that you brought up with the witches and, you know, this place called Blåkulla and, you know, how the heathen faith ties into so-called satanic, what Christians deem to be satanic and whatnot. So huge story there. Maybe we get a time at another point to talk more about that, because there's just so much to that. But Tracy, tell us more about the book, where people can get copies of it. It's a really nice hardcover that you sent to me. I really appreciate the book, and I've been going through it. Tell us how people can get it. Who wants to get a copy?
Well, you can just go to Amazon.com, and it's right there. And actually, they've got a nice discount on it, and you know, you can get super saver shipping, and it's sent out right away, pretty much. So. Yeah, that's the place to go. I'm not selling it on my website anymore. Just going to let people go to Amazon.
All right. Give us your website as well.
Sure. TracyTwyman.com. And there's lots of articles there and links to all my other books, which are also on Amazon.
All right. Simple enough. TracyTwyman.com. We'll have the website link up, and also, of course, a link to the book as well. All right. Well, stay with us, Tracy. We'll take a short break, and we'll pick this right up after that.